Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and let's start today with the end of the G20 Global Economic Summit. It concluded with six pledges to address the world economic crisis. Mark Gregory is the BBC's business correspondent. He joins us from London. Mark, among the pledges, we're seeing an additional $1 trillion to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank to loan to struggling countries, and policies to crack down on tax havens and regulate hedge funds. What else is jumping out at you?
Well, those are the key things. Probably the single biggest element in this package is an enormous dollop of extra funding for the International Monetary Fund. It's going to have its resources trebled to $500 billion, which gives it extra firepower, if you like, to help those economies, mainly middle-income economies, that have been badly battered by the global financial crisis. There's also going to be an entirely new $250 billion fund, which is going to be used for trade finance, to oil the wheels of commerce, to stop international trade drying up, and that's seen as one of the biggest problems. There's also going to be another $100 billion for the World Bank and other multilateral agencies to dole out to poor countries. So it's all being billed as a trillion-dollar package which will help stimulate the world economy.
Well, when you say the world economy, which economies might receive that $1 trillion? Which countries?
Well, this $1 trillion will primarily be of use to those countries that might go cap in hand to the IMF. So we're talking about poor and middle-income countries. It's unlikely that the wealthy countries, the US or Britain or France or Germany or anything like that, is going to go to the IMF. But, of course, the wealthy countries, their economies will be run into even bigger problems if, say, for example, the emerging economies in Eastern Europe run into real trouble. If you like, the wealthy countries have already spent so much money bailing out their own banks and that kind of thing, there's little left in the kitty to help out some of the middle order economies that are now running into very serious problems. So that's being billed as a big extra stimulus for the economy. But also, as you mentioned, there's a lot of stuff about extra regulation for the international financial system, which is going to mean closer supervision for hedge funds and credit rating agencies, and a list of non-cooperating tax havens, that's the jargon term being used, is being drawn up. And those tax havens will be perhaps named and shamed.
Well, and we also heard the phrase an end to bank secrecy. Is that part of that same thinking, or is this something additional?
Well, that's part of it, but I think the end to bank secrecy is really to do with the grand rhetoric that's coming out of the leaders' final statements rather than something in the communique. But this is really to do with this crackdown on tax havens. Mm-hmm. Those countries seen as non-cooperating are going to be given a deadline for bringing themselves into line. They're also going to be named, and there'll be a list published by the OECD.
Well, Mark Gregory, who's going to make all this happen? We heard going into the summit there were suggestions for a college of professors who would oversee this, and now we're hearing the phrase board of overseers. Who is that?
Well, there's talk that there's going to be a new international body. Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, used the term International Financial Stability Board, that's going to be created to oversee some of this stuff. Now, this is probably, if you like, going to be based on something that already exists, which is called the Financial Stability Forum, which is a body which involves central bankers and regulatory bodies who meet together. And it's really, at the moment, an organisation for exchange. Changing information. Perhaps it's going to be toughened up. It's unclear what this body is going to be, but there's going to be a new body created, which is going to have some sort of overall supervisory responsibility. Of course, the key thing is, though, where is all the money for all this coming from? And it seems to be coming from lots of different pockets.
Well, just in the last minute we have, this also includes curbs on executive pay. What's the sense that the economic elite around the world is going to bow to all of this?
Well, that's something that certainly gets mentioned, that there is an international agreement that there will be curbs on executive pay, though this and bonuses in particular, but this is something that for the moment is being specified for 1 year alone, for the period in which the international crisis lasts. Now, this, if you like, is rather vague talk, and it certainly fits in with what the French and the Germans were calling for. They were wanting very much tighter regulation of the international financial system, and also some sense, if you like, of the finger of blame being pointed. Exactly how it's going to work is fairly unclear. It's also unclear as to whether this is really going to put on much tighter new requirements on countries to actually do anything in advance of what they're already doing.
Mark Gregory, economics correspondent for the BBC. Thanks so much. Something to think about. You're rushed to the hospital for whatever the reason and things look bad. But your loved ones are confident that your last wishes regarding health care will be carried out because those wishes are outlined in your living will. But what if your living will is locked in your safe? Jane Brody says that's why you should carry a copy of your living will with your instructions in your wallet. It's just one of the thought-provoking ideas in the popular New York Times health columnist's thoughtful new book about death. Here are some of her other ideas. Did you know that people who are dying may be cold to your touch, but you shouldn't pile blankets on them? Even that weight is painful. That if someone is bedridden, by all means, touch them, but never massage their legs. It could loosen a fatal blood clot. Or that hearing is the last sense to leave the body, so don't say anything you wouldn't want the dying to hear. But as they go, by all means, say the things you want them to hear, because there's a good chance they can. Jane Brody's new book is called Jane Brody's Guide to the Great Beyond, a practical primer to help you and your loved ones prepare medically, legally, and emotionally for the end of life. And it's just that, everything she feels you should be thinking about at every stage of your life. And Jane joins us from the NPR studios in New York City. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. It's great to be here.
This is something very close to home to many, but definitely to you. You were, was it 16 when your mom died?
I was 16. It was just short of my 17th birthday. In those days, this was 1958, the C word, cancer, was never mentioned. The D word, death, was certainly never mentioned.
You know, I talk to young people who can't grasp that, that you just, you never talked about cancer to a cancer patient. They often didn't know what they had, and so therefore they couldn't talk back to you.
Yes. The result was my mother's death was a very, very painful experience for everyone, especially for her, because there was no goodbye, there was no last wishes, there was no legacy, there was nothing said, Mom, I love you, I will miss you, I treasure all the moments we had together, I'm just very sorry that there weren't more of them.
Well, and it was so lonely for her. You really
It was very lonely. She even tried twice to take her own life in the course of her illness.
She tried to slit her wrists and she drank rubbing alcohol. You know, just very sad.
Very sad, and that should have opened the door to a conversation, because obviously she knew she was in big trouble. And, of course, we knew she was in big trouble, and yet that conversation never took place. And unfortunately, even though this was 1958, this still happens all too often today.
Well, let's start that conversation then. Let's start with some of the practical advice. The living will, which I mentioned, which outlines what efforts you want made to prolong your life should you be unable to speak for yourself.
One of the things that people think that they've written out this living will, I don't want any extraordinary measures taken if my life hangs in the balance. And that is just not an adequate set of instructions for the physician. And it's not an adequate set of instructions for your family either. You need to spell out the circumstances as best as you can as to what you would want done under which circumstances. But that is not enough. Even that is not enough. What you need is a human being who can speak for you when you can't speak for yourself.
Who knows what's in that living will and maybe even knows where it is.
Exactly. And that person is called a healthcare proxy or healthcare agent, or who holds dual power of attorney for healthcare for you. When you are unable to communicate, that person is you, the patient, in absentia. It is absolutely vital to have this individual, and preferably a backup person as well, to have these conversations so that everyone's on the same page under what circumstances, what should be done.
Well, you give some examples. For instance, a person may have no problem with kidney dialysis, but may draw the line at a feeding tube. But you have to say that clearly because both are considered extraordinary measures.
That's correct. I mean, an extraordinary measure may be a respirator or a ventilator. Now, let's say, for example, you have advanced cancer, and you've written out this living will, and you say, if I'm about to die, let me die. But let's say you develop pneumonia, and you're not near death, but you could be near death from pneumonia.
If it's not treated.
Maybe a month from now, your granddaughter is getting married, or your daughter is having a child, your first grandchild, and you want to live to see that, treat the pneumonia. You can come back to your life and maybe live several more months or even several more years with your advanced cancer.
You give another example that's just really telling. I just want to share this one. A woman who said she did not want to be resuscitated in her living will. She was relatively young, in her 60s, and suddenly she breaks her leg, and then there's complications from the broken leg. Now, there's a sign over her in the hospital that says, DNR, do not resuscitate, and a doctor sees it and says, no, she doesn't mean don't treat me for my broken leg, even though it's gone into complications, and he saved her. So it's just, it's really thought-provoking. Let's talk about where to die, because you write it can have cultural significance. There are African-American families who want to care for dying family at home, but also believe that a death in the home is a bad luck. You know, some believe that. Chinese-American families share that, but also believe that a spirit can get lost if a death occurs in the hospital.
Well, I think do whatever works best for you. But, you know, whether you die at home or you die in a hospital or in a hospice, there are measures that can be taken to make that death as comfortable as possible. Hospice can be delivered in your home as well as in a facility.
Well, let's talk about hospice, because you say it's misunderstood, it's underused, and it's often used too late.
All of the above. About half the people who could benefit from hospice care and when they are dying do not get it. And it's free care. That's the joke of it all. It's covered under Medicare, and it's covered by insurance companies for people who are near to death.
But you write that Medicare and other insurers require that patients going into hospice care give up life-saving
treatment
measures.
For their disease. That, yeah. Exactly. No, not life-saving measures, but treatment for their disease.
Uh-huh.
They have to give up treatment for their disease, and the doctor has to certify that they believe this patient will not live longer than 6 months. Now, just because you get to 5.5 months and you're feeling fine doesn't mean that you have to then take your life to fulfill the requirements of hospice. Art Buchwald left hospice at 5.5 months and went home and finished writing his wonderful book called Too Soon to Say Goodbye.
But isn't that why a lot of people don't want to go into hospice? Because they just keep hoping that something will come along.
Some miracle. Yeah. Some miracle will come along, and it is very hard for people to give up on that belief. But that's why it's so important for doctors to be honest with their patients and not give them false hopes for recovery when they know, and almost invariably they know, that recovery is not going to happen.
How do they know? Because you write that in 1997, the American Medical Association recommended all hospitals develop a medical futility policy, you know, when no more treatment can help. But then there's been problems defining what futility is.
Yes, there are problems, and it's not an exact science. But, you know, you can come pretty close to the truth for most people, and it is really unfair to give patients a prognosis of long-term survival when, in fact, they're not likely to survive more than 3 months. Or, on the other hand, to say, you know, you're only going to live a couple of weeks when, in fact, you might be able to live 2 years.
That's New York Times health columnist Jane Brody. In a minute, we'll have more about doctors and death and what to say to someone who doesn't have time. Also, later today, what's a brush cat? That's later. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Health columnist Jane Brody's new primer on death is called Jane Brody's Guide to the Great Beyond. And Jane, a minute on doctors, because they like to save lives. They consider death a failure.
Many people go into medicine because they are the staunchest of death deniers. They are most afraid of death. And so there's a tremendous death denial culture in the medical profession. We need to turn that around, because it is just as important to help people die comfortably as to help them live comfortably.
On the other hand, I should note that you write about doctors who are exquisite at hand-holding with their patients in the final hours. And you give examples of why this kind of clear-eyed, compassionate thinking actually has physical ramifications. You tell the story of Manuel, who was dying and alienated from his son.
He had pain that could not be controlled until somebody found out about the son and made the effort to contact the son and put him into communication with his father, and they made their peace. And the amazing thing was that the dying man's pain just dissipated, having made peace with his son.
What do you do, though, Jane Brody, if your loved one is dying and they just don't want to hear about it and help you do the things that you have to do?
Well, there are things that you can say. Let's hope for the best. But you know what? Maybe things might not work out as we hoped, and so let's prepare for the worst as well at the same time. That sort of takes the curse off it.
Allowing them to accommodate but not accept.
Exactly. Yeah. And you really have to be on the same page with the patient. There are many patients who die very comfortably. My mother-in-law was one of them. I mean, she felt she was going to meet her maker, maybe meet up with her husband in heaven. She was very comfortable with death. But not everybody is like that. Some people will rage against the dying of the light, and the family has to accept that.
There is so much information in this book. What to say to people who are dying.
And what to say after somebody has died. You know, don't ask for the dead man's golf clubs.
That's the title of someone's book, because someone actually did that.
Exactly. The most important thing not to say is not to say you'll feel better tomorrow, or, you know, you're certainly getting better. You look a lot better than you did yesterday, and, you know, things are going well. You should not make any promises that you couldn't keep. But don't be afraid when you're visiting somebody who's dying to say you don't know what to say. Focus on the patient, what they might want to communicate, their hopes and concerns and fears. It's okay, for example, to talk about past times, fun things that you might have done together, memories that you'll share. It's very important to the dying person to know that they will be remembered by those things.
I want to touch on one thing, though. We know about physician-assisted suicide, but there are other programs, for instance, patient-controlled death, the volunteer organization that helps people with terminal illnesses who want to end their own lives in ways as simple as not eating. Just tell us about that.
Yeah, it's interesting because just the other day, somebody mentioned to me how distressed she was because that route of taking away nutrition was the way her cousin died. And she felt that it was cruel and inhuman punishment, when in fact it was the most beautiful thing that that family could have done for a dying patient who wanted out. It's a very comfortable way to die, actually.
Well, and many patients, my mom was among them. At a certain point, she stopped eating and drinking. And it's something that does happen naturally. And I love hearing this. So what happens when people are not taking anything in? You say it's a lovely way to die. Why?
It's very peaceful and it's not painful at all. People are not hungry. They get ice chips to keep their mouths moist. Whatever symptoms they may have that are uncomfortable are taken care of. Pain management is in place.
There's almost a euphoria.
Yes, it is a euphoric experience. People feel at peace. And, you know, one of the things that bothers survivors very often is when the dying patient seems to be turning inward. This is a natural thing for a dying person to do. They're not rejecting you. They know they're leaving life, and that inward turning is part of the process.
And again, you tell the story of one woman who was suffering ALS, terrible disease, and she made this choice. And that gave her the freedom to plan her baby daughter's birthday for the next 20 years.
Isn't that interesting?
Oh, and she bought 2 decades worth of gifts for this little girl.
Yes. I mean, there are many ways of leaving a lasting legacy. My sister-in-law has been writing essays about her growing up in rural Minnesota and what life was like when there was no running water or electricity or anything else. You can also leave messages to your children, to your grandchildren, the values that you want to instill in them, the love that you want to convey to them. It's a beautiful way to leave yourself behind.
So much more. There's another program I want to note in Eugene, Oregon. No one dies alone, so that if a family can't be right there, someone will come sit with a loved one, no matter
where.
Yes,
a volunteer. And I hope that program will be expanded nationwide because it is so valuable.
That's New York Times health columnist Jane Brody. Her book is Jane Brody's Guide to the Great Beyond, a practical primer to help you and your loved ones prepare medically, legally, and emotionally for the end of life. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Robin.
By the way, as you heard, Jane writes about assisted dying. Physician-assisted dying is only legal in Oregon and Washington State, but there are groups nationwide that offer support for terminally ill people who want to die, and one of those groups is in trouble. Four so-called exit guides from the Final Exit Network have been charged with illegal assisted suicide after an undercover investigator said they offered to hold his arms down while he inhaled helium, a method that would prevent a patient from changing his or her mind. If the Final Exit members are brought to trial, it could go a long way in clarifying the distinction between witnessing a suicide, which is legal, and assisting one, which is not. And a quick news note. Police in Ellensburg, Washington are looking for 42-year-old Robert Webb, who was caught on a surveillance camera robbing a store clerk at gunpoint, his 9-year-old daughter by his side.
Open the till and got me what you have. Call the cops, I'll come back and I'll kill you. Might have worked. My daughter's got to survive.
I'm out of work, he says. Police say Webb escaped with a couple $100s. The video shows his daughter skipping back to the car, apparently unaware of what had just happened. Crime experts say there is no sign of increased crime due to the recession. Here and now. Quick, how much money do you think the federal government has spent rescuing the U.S. economy? $30 billion to the auto industry, $180 billion to untangle AIG. Wow, that can add up. In fact, Bloomberg News estimates the total number is $12.8 trillion. Rick Newman is chief business correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. And Rick, first of all, what do you think of those Bloomberg numbers?
They're obviously very alarming. The total amount, which is almost $13 trillion, is about equivalent to total gross domestic product. That's the whole economy in the United States in a given year. But when you break them down, there's money that has been spent, there's money that has been pledged in the future, and then there are loans. If we're lucky, $13 trillion will end up to be a much smaller number once if this all works itself out.
Well, let's hope. And meantime, you've been doing an accounting of the money that has been spent, and we'd love to hear your numbers as well. Let's start with TARP. This is the Troubled Assets Relief Program. It was announced last October. It was supposed to unload those, you know, bad mortgages and things from banks to clear the way for credit. Didn't work that well. So the second plan is this sort of public-private loan buying program, the government using federal loans and subsidies to encourage private investors to buy up these bad investments. So first of all, how much money has been spent, and what's the thinking about how well the plan is working?
Well, the original Troubled Assets Relief Program, that was $700 billion, and most of that money has been either spent or committed, but not the way it was originally intended. So instead of going out and buying these troubled assets, that money has gone to banks. When you hear about investing in the preferred shares of banks, that's where it's gone. Some of that money has now gone to the automakers. A bunch of it has gone to AIG. And there are, I think, 500 banks at least that have gotten some of that money. And that will almost be spent pretty soon. The next part of this is this new public-private plan to buy up the troubled assets. That's going back to the original idea. The idea is to buy as much as $1 trillion worth of these things, and I think the majority of that spending would be financed by the government. So call it about $850 billion of that is either government loans or government spending, with a much smaller amount of money being spent by these private investors. And it's not clear that that program is even going to work.
Meanwhile, quick question. We heard testimony this week from the federal auditor who's, you know, overseeing TARP spending. He says banks are spending some of the money on securitized mortgages. Isn't that what got us into trouble in the first place?
It sure is. And at the end of the day, the real question is there's a set amount of losses that are out there on the bank balance sheets. Somebody has to bear those losses. And everything we're talking about is basically amounts to who is going to bear the losses. Taxpayers are going to bear a big chunk of this loss. Mm-hmm. It's already happened so far. And it's basically just figuring out the format by which taxpayers bear these losses.
Well, a couple other categories. Saving the domestic auto industry. Right now, you say the approximate cost is about $30 billion so far. Unwinding AIG, you write, this corporate disaster literally has a category all by itself.
I think the total commitment is $180 billion. That's more than the company was worth, incidentally. And we're not sure that that's the final tally for AIG.
One last category, homeowner bailouts. This is the Making Home Affordable program. It was supposed to help 3 to 5 million homeowners lower their monthly payments. What's been spent and how's that going?
That is about $75 billion. I think very little of that has been spent so far. But again, this is going to take months to find out, and we just don't know what kind of return the government's going to get on that money right now.
Rick Newman, Chief Business Correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. We really can't get a handle on how much has been spent. It's really a hard thing to get a handle on.
Right. It would be great if somebody were able to actually produce a running tally. I mean, President Obama has talked about more transparency, and he's got his website, recovery.gov. It might be a great thing for them to be able to put on there. So here's the amount of money that's been spent. We could maybe see a chart, like a thermometer chart or something like that. That'd be quite useful, but yeah, it's probably hard to figure out.
Rick Newman, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
By the way, sticking with economic news somewhat, did you notice that spangly off-white J. Crew sweater that Michelle Obama wore yesterday at the G20 summit in London? Did you also have that page earmarked in your catalog? Too late. According to J. Crew, the Crystal Constellation cardigan completely sold out within hours. Gee, didn't you like it better when first ladies like Nancy Reagan wore couture and left the other stuff to the rest of us? Before we go today, how globalization is affecting the independent loggers of New Hampshire, back in half a minute, here and now. Bob Benson handles his chainsaw with the authority of a Benihana chef. That's the way his friend Jack McEnany describes it. But after two decades in the woods of New Hampshire, that skill might not be enough anymore. Benson is one of the independent loggers featured in McEnany's new book, Brush Cat on Trees, the Wood Economy, and the Most Dangerous Job in America. Besides introducing us to the Brush Cats, characters like Logger Bob, Brush Cat also reminds us that Americans use 36 billion rolls of toilet paper every year, and that's 15 million trees, and much of that wood now comes from Siberia and Southeast Asia. Here now is Alex Ashlock. Met Logger Bob and Jack McEnany in Franconia, New Hampshire, in the White Mountains a few weeks ago. Jack told Alex mud season had already started, earlier than it used to, meaning the trees' woods were too wet and muddy for logging. Just another threat to the bottom line for loggers.
You know, loggers made a good living. You know, most loggers you see, they'd take ski vacations out west of Chamonix. They all owned fancy trucks. They all, you know, had snowmobiles and nice houses. A good logger could make himself $60,000-$70,000 a year. Then that was halved, and now it's maybe a third of that. And you see Bob is walking up here.
Right, here comes a good logger now, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know how much longer. Might be the end of an era for me.
Hi, Bob. Alex Ashlock.
Good to meet you, Alex.
Nice to meet you, too.
Hey, Jack.
Hi, Bob. How you doing, buddy?
Okay. Just drove up in Margo's Field to pack it down, so hopefully it'll freeze. Warm, though.
Yeah.
Spongy underneath. Yeah. We used to go till April 1st, and
yeah,
now it's
that's what Jack was telling
March.
Me.
It's amazing. Yeah, Lisbon just posted all the roads yesterday. Must have been right after I moved my skidder.
When you say posted the roads, you mean limits, so yeah, you can't drive the big trucks?
Right. But it's basically just logger specific because there's a clause for essential services and perishable goods. So the garbage truck goes, the fuel truck goes, everybody goes except log trucks. And it's been persecution because in the old days we could go with half a load out to a non-posted road, dump that off, go back, get another half a load. None of the towns let them do it anymore. I used to make a pretty good living, but, you know, between the climate change and the shorter winters and the wetter summers, which it has gotten wetter and warmer, and, you know, the insurance and everything going up and fuel, it's just we just get squeezed from every direction, and now the wood is down right in the toilet.
And you work by yourself, right?
Pretty much, yeah. I've had different, you know, crews over the years, but now it's all by myself. I couldn't afford to hire anybody else.
What are you going to do in the future?
I don't know. I've had to do something different. I've done different tree surgery, but I don't know. I'm almost thinking, you know, maybe teaching. You know, I taught skiing for years, and I like kids, and, you know, I get the degree in geology, so I might phase into that. I'm going to wait until the spring and see if the markets turn around, and if not, I can't keep going the way it is, and there's a lot of other guys like me. So, I don't know. I'm pretty discouraged, as you can tell, but I like working in the woods.
Tell me a little bit more about just why you like working in the woods so much.
Well, I like it because it's good exercise, first of all, you know, and it's good clean air, and you're out and you're basically your own boss. I mean, you have to meet us, you know, produce a certain amount of wood, but it's probably that and commercial fishing are the last independent, you know, jobs that I can see where somebody isn't totally breathing down your neck every minute of the day. I mean, I don't know, it's, I guess it's in your blood, sawdust in your veins.
You think you might have to leave the White Mountains?
No, I wouldn't. I don't think I'd leave here. This is a good spot to be, yeah.
What happens to most of the wood that gets logged up here now?
Boy, there's a pretty good percentage that's still used for pulp, for paper.
It'd be like toilet paper, stuff like that.
Toilet paper, paper bags, quality magazine paper, too, for some of the hemlock and spruce and fir. And then your hardwood grade logs would be sawed, you know, into boards for furniture or for, you know, whatever usages that is. And then there's...
That would be like pine, wood like that?
That would be the hardwoods. That would be the maple and the birch and then the oak. And then there's the white pine, which is a very good stable wood, and that's used for interior trim, door and window casings, and that type of stuff. And then there's spruce and fir, which is used for dimensional, what they call dimensional lumber, 2x4s, 2x6s, 2x12s. So really, we've lost some of these markets, but we have a huge, you know, diversity of species in this forest. We're on the border of the Appalachian hardwoods and the northern conifers. So they call this area the northern transitional forest. So we have elements of both of those forests, of course, depending on elevation. So we have more than your average number of species here. And we used to have a lot of markets for it all, but yeah, it's gone now.
Well, let's check out this chainsaw.
Okay.
Now, you said in the book, Jack, your dad wouldn't even let you use the lawnmower.
What the hell are you doing with the chainsaw?
Acting out, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. I'm a little accident prone, but I still have all my digits, you know. So Bob taught me how to be very, very careful with these things. And I took logger safety courses and other kinds of logger courses. So I will admit, I'm a little afraid of the chainsaw. And I think that's probably how you stay alive.
Is that a good thing? You should always be a little afraid of a chainsaw, yeah. When you get cocky, that's when you're going to get hurt. But the other thing is all the safety, and they make saw chain now that is got so many depth control teeth on it that it doesn't even cut. To my mind, anybody that buys a chainsaw should be required to buy a pair of chaps. The Kevlar chaps that we wear that I've
that you wear on your legs.
Times in my career, and it would have been a huge, ugly, bloody mess if I didn't have them on. They're $60. Anybody that hears this, buy a set of chaps if you have a chainsaw, because it's a really smart thing. You know, I don't cut without them, and I've been running the thing for quite a while now. You know?
Can you fire it up for me?
Sure.
Put it on the ground.
So when you said that wearing the chaps, now what happens when you're using the saw that makes it go down and hit your leg?
It's kickback, and the kickback point is at the tip of the saw. And that's the part where if that tip hits something and it's not full throttle and it's not cutting the wood, you get the 4-horsepower chainsaw reacting with that. And, you know, then that's when things happen. But it's a very good, it's like skidding in a car driving in the winter. It's very similar. You should know what it is, how to use it, how to be aware of it, not just have it happen as a surprise. And, you know, really anybody that buys a chainsaw should have to take a half an hour. It wouldn't be much just to teach them the basics. But in terms of professionals, I mean, we know how to use them. We've used them. Most loggers are killed by falling objects, and that's the real scary thing. You know, the chainsaw, you know, it might cut you, but it won't kill you usually.
Yeah. Well, Logger Bob, thanks for speaking to me and showing me how to use the chainsaw.
Yeah, well, it's not just that. It's hopefully that we get to continue using the chainsaw, and I don't know. I don't see a very good future in the industry. It's kind of sad, but I guess things have to change. That's my final note.
Thanks, Bob.
You're welcome.
So, Jack, just one more thing from you. Could you read the last paragraph of Brush Cat?
Sure. Love to. There's no monument to dead loggers, no honor roll inscribed on a plaque somewhere, and no outpouring of grief outside the immediate community when some poor brush cat checks out in the woods. I say there ought to be, but the loggers don't care. They don't need the validation. They just need healthy woodlots and 6 months a year to cut in them. And those days may simply be gone forever.
Jack McEnany's book is Brush Cat, On Trees, the Wood Economy, and the Most Dangerous Job in America. He spoke with Here Now's Alex Ashlock. Alex, please stick with a regular saw. For more, go to our website, herenow.org. I've waited with a By the way, tomorrow on Here and Now, Nico Case, who sings about forces of nature, including a heartbroken tornado. Let's listen a little. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. Using telescopes built with his own hands, Galileo Galilei changed the world in the 13th century. Only two of the dozens of telescopes Galileo made 400 years ago survive, and neither has ever left his adopted home, Florence, Italy, until now. One is on loan from the Florence Institute and Museum of the History of Science to the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia for their new exhibit, Galileo, the Medici, and the Age of Astronomy. To mark the event, Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, appeared on the Colbert Report and showed Stephen Colbert a 60-year-old replica of Galileo's looking glass.
Now, which end do I look through?
Okay. You're looking through that end there.
Uh-huh.
Let and the see. Other is the business end.
Oh, a lot of lovely ladies out there tonight.
Derek Pitts joins us now from WHYY in Philadelphia. Derek, that was a 60-year-old replica. You also now have the 400-year-old real thing. How happy are you?
I'm elated, actually. It's quite an experience to have such a significant instrument right here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, well, tell us more about it. What does it look like?
It actually looks like a long wooden tube with no special use.
Well, some people who've seen it have said it sort of looks like a high school, you know, one of those projects you had to get done quickly. Build a telescope. What's it made out of?
It's made out of all of the ingredients that you would use for a high school project, actually. It's actually two halves of a cylinder of wood. Very much like you might find a tree branch that's been hollowed out. Mm-hmm. And those two halves are put together around the optical elements. And then the tube is held together with copper wire. And then the tube is wrapped in paper that's been finally varnished.
Well, and we understand it's the color of 400-year-old cardboard.
Yes, that's about right.
Yeah. And what did he do with it?
Well, Galileo did a remarkable thing. There was an observer before Galileo that looked at the moon, but that observer, a gentleman named Thomas Harriot in England, did not publish any of his observations. So here's what Galileo did. Galileo not only looked at the moon, but he also observed Jupiter, Saturn, Venus, and also the sun for sunspots. He also looked at the Milky Way. But the most important step for him was to write it all down, take very careful notes, and then publish those notes as soon as he possibly could. So just after he finished his major observations in January of 1610, he began publication of his first book, Sidereus Nuncius, The Starry Messenger. In doing so, he got the word out about what he was doing way before Thomas Harriot did that. And so that's how Galileo gets the credit for having done so much right. in astronomical observing first.
And just remind us, what did he see that was the big aha, you know, with these rudimentary telescopes? It's, you know, it's always hard to place ourselves back there, but what did he see?
The real big aha for Galileo was his observation of Jupiter. What he saw was that Jupiter was a world rather than a star, and that this particular world seemed to have its own stars in orbit around it. And this big aha moment took him right to what he had been learning about Copernicus. Nicholas Copernicus had put out the idea that the sun stands at the center of the universe, as they called it at that time, and everything else orbits around that, including the Earth, meaning that the Earth moves. So Galileo's observation of Jupiter with its four brightest, what we now call moons, provided for him the first visual suggestion of the possibility that Copernicus was correct.
Right, that the sun, not the Earth, was the center of the universe. And that leads to Galileo's standoff with the Catholic Church. Former presidential speechwriter Richard Goodwin has written a play about Galileo's relationship with the Vatican. It's running here in Boston. It's called Two Men of Florence. It stars J.O. Sanders as Galileo and Edward Herman as Pope Urban VIII. And here's a scene.
People will ask, if Earth is not the center, where does the devil live? Or if we are a planet among other planets, then of Adam and the Great Flood, did they happen on all the worlds? You see the morass that lies in that direction.
How can I describe the world if it is maintained that Scripture forbids its description?
Well, Scripture sets no limit to thought. If we can better understand the world by assuming that the Earth moves, we can do so, as long as we do not insist that it actually moves.
So, Derek Pitts, eventually Rome accuses Galileo of heresy, puts him on trial. He spent the last years of his life under house arrest. And here you have in your midst this thing that ultimately elevated mankind, but as we see, brought Galileo down.
Well, the way I say it is that what Galileo did with his telescope was to open the universe to astronomical research. And open the universe really is a very powerful way to describe what came, what the legacy of his work was with the telescope. However, it did get him into trouble, but we have to actually say eventually, because this story about Galileo with the church is actually quite deep. It's a multidimensional story. Galileo was very, very good friends with a number of very highly placed cardinals and with a few popes. And virtually every step along the way of his astronomical observations, he reviewed what he was seeing with the cardinals and with the Pope and talked about the implications of what he had observed, discussing with them how it might be possible for them to accept this idea. Galileo really worked very hard to try to keep the Catholic Church from making a very big mistake.
Well, back to the telescope at the centerpiece of the story. No one is allowed to touch it. It's way too fragile. Some privileged people have been able to look through the lens. Have you been able to do that?
Yes, I've been able to examine the telescope at very close range, from about 4 inches away, using a high-powered hand magnifier, and I did get to look through the optics.
And what did you see?
Well, the other side of the room, actually, but it was still an interesting image. And to have the opportunity to receive light into my eye through glass that was fashioned by Galileo, I think, is for me a great experience.
Oh, it's got to be a lifetime dream. And we understand that near one end, there's a little bit of writing. What does it say?
It actually says the word focal, the numeral 3, and the word piedi, which is Italian for feet. So these three words together are interpreted to refer to the focal length of the instrument. And the really wonderful thing about this, Robin, is that these words were written by Galileo.
And for an astronomer like you, what else does it do?
It's a semi-religious experience, because now I see the direct ancestor of Hubble Space Telescope and all of the other big telescopes in use around the world today. And without Galileo's first steps, it would have been a much later time when we had come to discovering the heavens as we have.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at Philadelphia's Franklin Institute. Galileo's telescope will be on display there as part of their exhibit, Galileo, the Medici, and the Age of Astronomy. It opens Friday. For more, go to our website, herenow.org. And Derek, thank you so much, and enjoy the exhibit.
Thank you very much, Rob. I sure will.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.